Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Martyrs and Missionaries is a production of Revive Studios. You're listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise, and in every episode, I'll bring you a new martyr and or missionary, the called and the brave. In this episode, we're covering part one of the father of modern missions, William Carey. The time has finally arrived. This podcast has been going on for about 4 years now, actually a little bit over 4 years now, and I have yet to cover the father of modern missions, and so we will procrastinate no longer. This will be a two-part episode. This biography will be a little bit different in that I want to kind of include Dorothy as much as possible in this account, because a lot of times she's just a footnote in the story, and I feel that's kind of unfair to her, or if she's mentioned, it's kind of like she's a blight to William's overall story. And I do have a few quotes about her from other biographers, which I will read later. But Dorothy, as many of you will know, went insane for the last 12 years of her life, essentially the entire time that she was in India. And one of his biographers noted that if William was the father of modern missions, Dorothy is not its mother. And I think that title probably goes to another member of the Serampore mission, Hannah Marshman. We will talk more about Dorothy later, but for now, I want to get started with William's story. So one of the books I have been reading for this episode is called Faithful Witness, The Life and Mission of William Carey by Timothy George. It is a fantastic book. And he sets the stage for the birth of William by giving us the context into which he was being born. He says he's brought into the world on August 17th, 1761. And John Wesley's at the height of his influence. George Whitefield is poised to kick off the Great Awakening in the American colonies. And the Handel's Messiah was still new. And King George III had just been crowned king. And the 7 Years' War between England and France in the Americas was still raging. William, however, doesn't know anything about this or even care because he is just a baby. He was born into the little village of Pollersbury in the heart of England, about 22 hours walking or 1.5 hours drive from London, but they weren't driving Bentleys yet, so they were definitely walking, and he didn't go that way for quite a while. And William was named by his grandmother in honor of the loss of her own son many years ago, and it seems like she had also lost her husband to suicide shortly after the baby's death. So in this way, it's kind of like William is a bit of a redemptive possibility for her son and how that story kind of ended. William's father was the headmaster of the local charity school, which at the time was not a respected profession, but perhaps because his father was a teacher, William grew up with an insatiable thirst for knowledge. He loved reading, and his favorite book was Pilgrim's Progress, but not for its religious overtones, merely for the adventure. And he loved plants, and he was a budding little botanist. His sister recalled that he always was going off the path from their walks to grab random plants and bugs. And his uncle Peter served in the British military, and he would regale William with these stories of his adventures in the Americas and wherever else he had been. And William may well have made his living as a botanist or an adventurer, if not for a severe allergy he developed at the age of 7, which was made worse by the sun. And I know there's a British joke in there somewhere, but I can't quite find it, so you'll have to come up with one on your own. But interestingly, this kind of altered his life trajectory into the more sedentary and shaded life of a shoemaker. But his allergy is never mentioned again, as far as I could tell. And India is not exactly a shady place, so I don't really know if maybe he outgrew it or something like that. Not sure. But anyway, at the age of 14, he becomes apprenticed to a shoemaker, and that's how he will make his living for the next 14 years of his life. And his master, or his boss, had another apprentice by the name of John Warr, and Warr was a dissenter. And English dissenters were those who did not conform to the doctrines of the Church of England, and historically they were a persecuted group, although they were not by any means united. You had tons of branches of the dissenters. dissenters. But there are many notable people in their midst. For example, you have John Bunyan. But they disliked the church and state marriage that the Church of England maintained, considering it too Catholic to be Protestant. And their persecution would end with the Toleration Act of 1689, which allowed for freedom of worship, but it denied them the ability to hold political office or attend universities, and that is still going on in William's day. So John Warr was one of these guys, and he really introduced William to the gospel. Because although he had grown up as Church of England, he said he didn't really know much of real experimental religion until he met Warr. And Warr was quite persistent in challenging William to accept the faith, because previously William had said he had given very little thought really to spiritual or higher things. Carey wrote that he had been trying to improve himself due to the influence of his friend, but it wasn't until he was really brought a little bit low that he finally rounded a corner towards actual saving faith. He relates, "I had been to Northampton, where I made some purchases for myself, which amounted to about a shilling more than I was worth. But I had a counterfeit shilling which Mr. Hall, the ironmonger, had given me as a Christmas box. I knew it to be a bad shilling, but I was strongly inclined to assert to my master that it belonged to other money, with which he had entrusted me to purchase things for him, as it would clear my private account. I recollect the struggle I had all the way home, and I prayed to God to excuse my dishonesty and lying for this once. I would never repeat such an action, but would break off with sin thenceforth. My wickedness prevailed, and I told the falsehood and was detected by my master. A gracious God did not let me get safe through. I soon concluded that my theft was known to the whole village, and so I concealed myself from all as much as I could, and was so overwhelmed with shame that it was a considerable amount of time before I went out again." And soon after this event, he committed his life to Christ. And he and Warr would also lead their master to the Lord on his deathbed. And as this man lay dying, he pleaded with others to flee to Jesus as the sinner's friend. And then Carey turned his newfound zeal on his parents, and his sister relates that he kind of drove them up a wall. Those weren't her exact words, but the sentiment was the same. She said that it was as though he had all the answers and was now so much better than they were. And I think today we would kind of classify him as a cage stage Calvinist, but that stage does eventually pass, and his persistence, along with his humility that comes with maturity and sanctification, won them over, and it appears they too became believers. On February 10th, 1779, King George declared a day of fasting and prayer because England was losing its war in the colonies, and Warr invites Carey to participate in this with a group of dissenters meeting in the next town over. And the guest preacher that day was Thomas Chatter, who had come over from the Church of St. Peter and St. Paul in Olney, which has a quite impressive history. At this point, their parish priest was none other than John Newton. Now, Thomas Chatter preached on the cost of discipleship, and from this sermon, Carey felt that he needed to officially move away from the Church of England and publicly join the dissenters. And then Thomas takes Carey under his wing and then mentors him, later recommending him to a small congregation where he would preach every other Sunday. And eventually, he introduces Carey to the Northamptonshire Baptist Association, and this association had been formed by six particular Baptists, and today we would just call the particular Baptists like Reformed Baptists. But this had been formed about 20 years before, and since then had grown quite considerably. At this meeting, he was introduced to John Collett Ryland, who is a well-known minister and author, and his son, John Ryland Jr., was also in attendance. And then there's John Sutcliffe of the church at Olney. And lastly, there was Andrew Fuller, who is also a pastor, but of whom William Wilberforce described as having a visage of a village blacksmith, though no less agile of mind or lips for that. And if you want to know more about Fuller, and I know you do, you can listen to Revived Thoughts, who has done at least one of his sermons. I will link it, but it was sadly not the one that was preached on this day, but I'm sure it's just as good. So Carey was thoroughly a dissenter, but he was not yet a Baptist, and he heard a sermon on paedobaptism or infant baptism, and he just wasn't convinced. So he decided to research it more strictly from Scripture. And with study, he felt that it was necessary to have a believer's baptism by immersion. So he applies for baptism with John Collett Ryland, who gave him a pamphlet and then passed him along for baptism at the hands of his son. And at the time, the younger Ryland just wrote in his journal something along the lines of, "Baptized a poor journeyman shoemaker today." But looking back on it, about 30-odd years later, he wrote, "On October 5th, 1783, I baptized a poor journeyman shoemaker, little thinking that before 9 years elapsed, he would prove the first instrument of forming a society for sending missionaries from England to the heathen world, and much less that he would later become professor of languages in an Oriental college and the translator of the scriptures into 11 different tongues. We actually need to back up just a little bit because 2 years before this, he had married Dorothy Plackett, and Dorothy was the sister-in-law of his new boss, Thomas Old. Dorothy's family also attended the same dissenting meeting house that John Warr introduced Carrie to. The two were married in 1781 when William was 20 and Dorothy was 25, which was a bit of an unusual dynamic at the time because they usually married a lot younger. And biographers like to note that Dorothy wasn't literate at the time of their marriage because she marked her name with an X. This is kind of used to show just how illiterate she was and how just unsuited she was for William. But only about a little over half of men in England could read and less than half of women. So especially considering her social standing, it actually would have been pretty shocking if she could have read because her village didn't even have a school in it. But later on, she did learn to read and write, most likely being taught by William. And early in their marriage, they lost their first child, Anne, to a terrible fever when she was only 2 years old. And that same fever nearly took William as well and left him basically bald for the rest of his life. And he wore this really bad wig until he moved to India and just let it be. And this is where I think his sun allergy must have kind of cleared up because no one would do that if they had an allergy. But when William's mom came to visit them one time, she was just shocked at their abject poverty. But soon they were to become even more impoverished because Thomas Old, who is William's new boss, had just died, leaving behind his wife, who is Dorothy's sister, and four small children. And William and Dorothy took them in, which made it a lot harder for them to make ends meet. So William was forced to preach while still making shoes, and he'd opened a night school for village children. And this seems to be the first one they actually had in Piddington. So that's where Dorothy grew up, which is pretty impressive. But then he was recommended to try out for the pastorate only, which is quite prestigious, as I had said. And he came and preached a sermon there, but it must have gone really poorly because they wrote down that basically he could try again later, which is pretty embarrassing. And so instead, he takes a position at a church in Moulton. Everybody there loved him. And Andrew Fuller came to visit and hear him preach. And then afterward, he grabbed William by the hand and he said, "We must know more of each other." And after a year's probation, he was formally installed in 1787 when he's about 26 years old. And they were still physically quite poor, but God had given them three boys. They had Felix, William, and Peter. And then Dorothy's sister Kitty would come to visit them quite frequently, and they had a loving congregation. In the same year that her husband was ordained, Dorothy was baptized by immersion. And a couple years before this, James Cook, the famous explorer and British naval captain, he had these journals and adventures, which were published into three volumes. And they kind of took the world by storm. Everybody was reading these things or having them read to them. And average people were exposed to worlds and peoples they had never even heard of. And many Christians felt the pain of all those lost souls who were living in the cannibal isles of the South Seas. James Cook himself is not a religious man. He wrote, "No one would ever venture to introduce Christianity into Erromanga because neither fame nor profit would offer the requisite inducement," which is a difficult way of saying it's just not worth it. But he was wrong because six missionaries would go on to lose their lives evangelizing on Erromanga, and their sacrifice would encourage more missionaries to go, and they eventually evangelized the Cook Islands. And not surprisingly, Carrie is one of those people that Cook's adventures had a profound impact on. And he also greatly admired John Eliot, who was a missionary to the Native Americans in the colonies. And one day I want to do an episode on him. But he also loved The Diary of David Brainerd. And it was one of those books he took with him to India, and it also helped sustain him during those rough days ahead. And then also he loved the story of the Moravians. He's a huge Moravian fan. And I think maybe they were doing some good work out there, and he hadn't listened to the episode yet, so he just didn't know what was going on there in Germany. But yeah, he's just a huge Moravian fan. And Andrew Fuller rode down to visit him one day, and he walks into his shop where he had this roughly made map of the world with the peoples who lived there and their population, and he was using it to study global needs and to pray. And he was also compiling a book he wanted to name, and hold on, it's An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens, in which the religious state of the different nations of the world, the success of former undertakings, and the practicability of further undertakings are considered. His publishers do eventually convince him to shorten it just a little bit, and everybody today calls it an inquiry. But it was a short book that covered the church history from the apostles to the modern age, the need for missions, and an answer to objections and basic methodology. And it wouldn't be published until 1792, about a year before William will leave for the mission field. And as his missionary zeal continued to grow, he hounded Sutcliffe and Ryland and Fuller until they too were convinced of the need to form a missions organization. And William lamented the fact that so many sons of Adam lived in darkness, and he saw these people not as statistics, but he felt the weight of each soul. And this was emphasized even later when the organization consecrated their first group of missionaries to Africa. John Ryland Jr. reminded them of the worth of a single soul, saying, "Think of the worth of a single soul, a soul delivered from eternal death and made an heir of eternal bliss. Could you, brethren, at the present awful period, when the continent of Europe is deluged with human blood and the earth fattened with murdered corpses, could you still the madness of the people and hush the incessant nations to peace? Could you produce universal harmony and order and revive trade and commerce in every country, now distracted by the wicked passions of men? And could you ensure all of Europe for a whole century, or for a thousand centuries, then the inestimable blessing of peace, would not your names be recorded in history as the benefactors of mankind? Would you not be almost idolized as the temporary saviors of the world? Yet all the sum of happiness that could be enjoyed on earth by all the inhabitants of Europe in a thousand centuries, wherein the whole infernal art of war should be forgotten, and the most friendly intercourse should subsist between all nations, and a temporal prosperity bless every realm, the whole sum of this happiness will be exceeded by the bliss of a single converted African, which he shall enjoy in a boundless and blessed eternity." That is an incredible word picture, isn't it? 2 years after he had been installed at Moulton, he was asked to come and be the pastor at a Harvey Lane church in Leicester, which doesn't look anything like Leicester, but it is Leicester. It was a difficult decision for him because he had loved his little congregation and they loved him. And in Leicester, he was for the first time a city pastor. And he was introduced to a wide circle of influential and scholarly Christian men. And one of these men, Dr. Arnold, had a growing interest in the care of the insane and established a special hospital for them. And he also published a few volumes on the subject, which Carey providentially brought with him to India. And he had the access to the libraries of these men and took full advantage of it, soaking in all the knowledge they held. And while William was connected to wealthy and powerful men, he was not one of them. At 28, he still supplemented his income with shoemaking and with teaching, and Dorothy was also pregnant again, so they had to make everything stretch even further still. And hiding behind this very tempting offer at Leicester was the fact that they had a lot of problems. Because they'd actually been through several different pastors and there was this church split and just a lot of dissension going on. So what they decided to do was just dissolve the church entirely and then rebuild it, not like physically, but like rebuild the membership for people who actually wanted to be a part of the church. And with time, it actually thrived and grew and it was a much more healthy and happy church. But around this time, not so happy, they lost their daughter, Lucy, who was not yet 2 years old. And William's sister recalled that for a time, every one of his letters mentioned her. So it's a bittersweet time. And when he was officially installed as the pastor at Harvey Lane in 1791, a young man named Samuel Pierce preached his installation sermon. And Samuel is about 5 years younger than William, and everybody loves this guy. He was a deeply devout man with a zeal for holiness, as well as a deep fervor for mission work. And he became one of William's closest friends, and later he so wanted to join his friend in India that he studied Bengali, and he was one of the 12 founding members of the Baptist Missionary Society, but he was never able to go himself, in part because he had contracted tuberculosis, which led to his death a few years after William left for the field. But his son, also named William, later went out to India as a missionary, and later his daughter Anna married Carey's youngest son, Jonathan. So that's a pretty sweet legacy. Now, speeding forward a little bit, Carey had been hounding his friends to finally form this missionary society, and they kept delaying and would just never make it official. And in May 1792, Carey's book had been published and was making waves, and signs of revival were on the horizon, and Carey really wanted to capitalize on it. So he preached this fervent sermon before his fellow ministers from Isaiah about enlarging the tent and lengthening the ropes, ready for God to do these amazing things. And the sermon ended with these now famous words, "Expect great things, attempt great things." Later, the "from God" and "for God" were added to provide context to the original point. And the next morning, the ministers gathered together to discuss business as usual, and Carey was so frustrated by the lack of momentum and urgency that he grabbed Fuller by the arm and he cried, "Is there nothing again to be done, sir?" And they decided that next month, at their next meeting, they would discuss the formation of a missionary society. And that summer, tragedy befell the home of Andrew Fuller because his wife had been suffering from a terrible depression since the death of their daughter a few years before. And she was pregnant again and began suffering these hallucinations and was so disoriented that oftentimes she could not even recognize her own husband. And then she passed away in childbirth. And Fuller, as he was grieving the loss of his wife, prepared to host their next meeting in October. And this group of men who would gather at this meeting were 14 virtual unknowns. And Fuller was kind of well-known, but not really at this point. And they served in these tiny churches, and the oldest among them was only 40 years old. The youngest was 26. And they all, with the exception of one, had no money to speak of. And looking back, it's kind of an absurd picture because are these really the guys that God would use to start a worldwide movement? And these doubts almost won out, and Carey had to pull out a pamphlet on the recent work of the Moravians who were going far and wide. Can the Baptists at least try to make an effort? And so finally, they made a decision. And I'm going to read from the book here by Timothy George. This says, "Humbly desirous of making an effort for the propagation of the gospel amongst the heathen, according to the recommendations of Carey's inquiry, we unanimously resolved to act in society together for this purpose, and as in the divided state of Christendom, each denomination, by exerting itself separately, seems likeliest to accomplish the great end, we name this the particular Baptist Society for the propagation of the gospel among the heathen." Five men were appointed to oversee this work. Fuller was the secretary, a man named Hogg was the treasurer, with Ryland, Sutcliffe, and Carey completing this inner circle. And at the next meeting, Samuel Pierce brought a sizable gift of £70 from his church in Birmingham, and he was added to this number as well. And they passed around this snuff box, which was decorated with the conversion of Paul, which is kind of a funny thing to think about now, but they gathered £13, 2 shillings, and 6 pence. Now, I'm not an 18th century Englishwoman, but even I know that's not that much money. One of the slips actually read anon, but it was pledged 10 shillings and 6 pence, which was the smallest amount promised that evening. And it turned out that it belonged to a man named William Stoughton, who was a theological student from Bristol. And he was baptized by Pierce, and he was destined to become one of the leading members, pastors among the Baptists in America. And he never forgot that evening, and nor lost his zeal for missions. What Fuller was to become in England, Stoughton became in America, and he was just this incredible advocate for missions. Years later, when serving as a corresponding secretary for the American Baptist Missionary Convention, he recalled that small but solemn gathering in the back parlor of that godly home, that gift he had offered his widow's mite, he saw as one of the best achievements of his life. He said, "I rejoice more over that 10 and 6 pence than over all I have given in my life besides." At this point, people began to assume and wonder whether William would be sent out as a missionary himself. And he wrote a letter to his father to allay his fears, because his father was just like, "You're not going out on the mission field. I won't have it." So he wrote that he had been asked to become a missionary to Sierra Leone, which had recently been founded as a haven for free slaves. And he assured his father that he had turned it down. And his church was growing, and he must have wondered if they would actually consent to him leaving as well. His wife also wasn't really pushing for it either, because undoubtedly she had heard all about these exploits of Cook and the hardship of other missionaries and felt that it really wasn't something she wanted to do. She had 3 little boys at home with one on the way, and she'd also never left this 8-mile radius where she had been born, and she was deeply attached to her family. And William wrestled with his role in missions, but in the meantime, he looked for profitable areas to send future missionaries. And he was leaning towards Tahiti until a man named John Thomas arrived from India looking for people to go back with him. Now, John Thomas is a character. He is very charismatic and animated, with the ability to cast a vision to whomever and whatever he was thinking about in that moment. He loved the Lord, but he wasn't the most emotionally stable of men. And he was employed as a ship's surgeon about a decade prior when he first saw Calcutta, which is the capital of the Bengal state of India, way up in the northeast. And he came back to London, where he set up a surgical practice and shared the gospel wherever and whenever he could. And he was a terrible businessman, and so his surgery went under, which is an unintentional pun. And so he returns to India a couple years later, and he met up with Charles Grant, who was a Christian high up in the East India Company. And he began studying Bengali and translated Matthew, Mark, and James. And his moods were wildly unpredictable, and this is perhaps what led him to separate a bit from Charles, who then cut him loose. And he'd come back to England looking for people to accompany him in the translation and evangelization work, and also for people to underwrite his projects. The society looked into making him their missionary, and they decided that he passed all the requirements, despite his worrisome debts and checkered past, and his debts would be a great source of consternation later on. But Thomas was not expected to be at this particular meeting because he had injured his foot, and Thomas was approved for missionary service, and then Carey was asked if he would like to go with him, and the minutes record that he answered in the affirmative. And a little bit after this, Thomas comes in, and Carey runs out to go meet him, and they fall on each other and are, like, weeping on each other's necks and stuff, and it's a very, like, emotional moment. And it's one of those seemingly rushed decisions, but it was clearly something he'd been working through and decided to take that leap of faith. And Carey famously told Fuller around this time that he would go down into the pit if he would hold the rope. And Fuller replied that he would most certainly hold the rope, and he did so faithfully for the next 20 years until his death. Now, Dorothy is not amused when he arrives home and tells her the news, and she refuses to go. No amount of pleading and begging would change her mind. And she eventually does agree that he can take their 8-year-old son, Felix. And you have to be thinking, what's going on in her mind right now? Does she think that she'd ever see her son again? Because you can go out there, you can catch tropical diseases, you might never return, and there's a war on and all sorts of stuff. You know, it's or there will be a war on very soon. So there's just a whole lot of things that are just, you just don't know. These are the early days of missions. Just nobody knows how to do it or what it really looks like. And to complicate matters a little bit further, any British citizen who wanted to go to India needed to have a license from the East India Company, and they didn't give out licenses to missionaries. If you didn't have a license, you faced fines, imprisonment, or at the very least, you got shipped back to England after having all your belongings confiscated. So Dorothy probably knows all of this, and this is just not encouraging news to her at all. So she says, no, I'm not going to go. And Carey's not oblivious. He's nervous about these things as well. And so he goes to John Newton to seek his counsel. And Carey asked him, what if the company should send us home on our arrival to Bengal? And Newton replied, then conclude that your Lord has nothing there for you to accomplish. And then he added, but if he does have, then no power on earth can hinder you. And later on, Newton was to say about Carey that such a man as Carey is more to me than bishop or archbishop. He is an apostle, which is really high praise. Meanwhile, John Thomas had convinced the ship on which he had formerly served as a surgeon to take them aboard without a license. So William, Felix, John Thomas's wife, his daughter, and two of his cousins boarded the ship and set off to the Isle of Wight to await their convoy, because just 2 months before this, France had declared war on England, and so no ship was to sail alone, because that's foolish. So they waited for 6 weeks on the Isle of Wight, and then William receives news that Dorothy had given birth to their youngest son, Jabez, and he wrote to Dorothy to attempt to convince her once again to join them. He said, "You want to know what Miss Thomas thinks and how she likes the voyage? She is very delicate, brought up very genteel, and cousin to Squire Thursby of Abingdon." Abingdon? Abingdon. "She was in good spirits, and the sea agrees with her very well. She sends her love to you and is glad to hear the good news concerning your delivery. She would rather stay in England than go to India, but thinks it's right to go with her husband." It's not really a very subtle attempt, but it doesn't work either way. And in kind of a predictable turn of events, Thomas's debts get them kicked off the ship because he owes someone over £100. The others are free to go, but William, Felix, and John cannot. So they have to kind of scramble to figure out what to do. And eventually they do secure money and passage with a Danish ship, which is due to arrive any day. So they make one final attempt to convince Dorothy, and John comes too. And arguably he had a way with Dorothy that William just didn't. He was the only one who could calm her in those later years when she lost her sanity. And he tells her in this moment that her refusal to join the venture would cause her family to be dispersed and divided forever, and that she would repent of it as long as she lived. In light of this, she agrees to go, but only if her sister Kitty would come along with her. And Kitty agrees to go, And on June 13th, 1793, they set sail. And Carey wrote in his journal on that first day, "This, I hope, was a day of joy to my soul. I was returned to take all of my family with me and to enjoy all the blessings which I had surrendered up to God. This is an Ebenezer which I raise to God, and I hope to be strengthened whenever I reflect upon it."
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
They end up spending 5 months on this boat with John teaching William Bengali and then William attempting to do some translation work. And Dorothy is really anxious and fearful, which William records in his journal. But she improves once they kind of round the Cape of Good Hope. However, William wrote that he feared the ship's company had corrupted Kitty and Dorothy, although he doesn't really elaborate on what he means exactly, so we just don't know. And then finally, in the middle of November, they arrive in Calcutta, but they actually slip ashore a few days before the ship officially docks. They can kind of sneak in and nobody has to know they're there. And when they got there, they brought all this silverware with them and other goods to sell so that they could kind of set themselves up. But it doesn't sell for hardly anything because the market is already oversaturated. So they're poor and it's already off to a rocky start. So they have to actually move outside of Calcutta, and they go about 30 miles outside the city where they're surrounded by these mosquitoes, and mosquitoes are bad news, right? They carry lots of diseases. And to add to this, speaking of blood-sucking insects, Thomas's creditors had followed him out to India, and he has this this arrest warrant out for him, and so he's forced to stay in Calcutta to set up a surgery to pay off his debts. Now, he takes all the money that they had set up for themselves, like to start the mission. He takes it all, uses it to buy himself a nice house with 12 servants and a coach to ferry him around the city. And in his diary, Carey confided, "Now all my friends are but one. I rejoice, however, that he is all sufficient and can supply all my wants, spiritual and temporal." And he later wrote, "I am alone in a strange land, no Christian friends, a large family, and nothing to supply their wants." So he's feeling really, really alone. And Felix and Dorothy were horribly ill with dysentery. And in fact, Dorothy kind of suffered with it for the rest of her life. It would kind of come and go in bouts. And to kind of try to make some money so they can do the mission work, he applies for this, or tries to apply for this botanical garden job. But by the time he gets there, it's already been given to somebody else. And then there's an associate of the East India Company who John Newton knew about. So he goes to see this guy. And then once this guy hears that he's associated with John Thomas, he doesn't even offer him a glass of water in the unbearable heat. And you kind of have to wonder at this point if Carey's kind of like regretting signing up with John Thomas. Like, I don't know if he saw there were like, you know, yellow flags or something. But he actually is very gracious to, for all the things that John Thomas does, he's very gracious to him. And I think he knows there's just something not quite operating at full capacity up there on certain times, because he's so patient with him, and he takes him back time and time again. And he never really questions the sincerity of Thomas. He just realizes he's, I think, a bit manic. It would kind of be what you would maybe describe him as today, where he just has these mood swings where he almost like he can't control himself, I think. They've since moved into a ramshackle hut outside of Calcutta, and Kitty and Dorothy are very unhappy. They're constantly griping about Carey, and they're jealous of Thomas, who's set up in this lovely, lovely house. And honestly, they're having a really hard adjustment, and you really can't blame them, because nothing is familiar. The language, the food, the culture. And Carey writes to Sutcliffe at this point. He says, "If my family were but hardy in the work, I would find a great burden removed." And this is definitely, I feel like, relatable. Like you can sympathize with him. But on the other side, you can also sympathize with Dorothy and Kitty because they're moving around quite a lot. It's hot. They're miserable. They're sick. And it's funny. There's like a quote, and I can't remember exactly the full context, but he's kind of complaining in his journal that they were wanting things like bread. You know, so he's prepared to go full in like the India immersion experience. And he's like, no, we don't eat bread anymore. It's rice from here on out. And they were just like, we don't want that. So he just is on a different path than they are. He's vibing a different way. But every Sunday, he and John preached in the streets and the open air markets of Calcutta. And Thomas does most of speaking at this point because Carrie is still learning. But he decides, and I think this is, like I said, pretty incredible. He's still working with John Thomas, even after how he had treated him. He doesn't think he's malicious. He just has this poor judgment and instability. So Carey's commitment to sharing the gospel whenever he was doing really is impressive. He wrote this in his diary. February 1st, spent today in preparations for our departure on Monday to the intended place of our residence. Was very weary, having walked all in the sun about 15 or 16 miles, yet had the satisfaction of discoursing with some money changers at Calcutta, who could speak English, about the importance and absolute necessity of faith in Jesus Christ, our Lord. One of them was a very crafty man and tried much to entangle me with hard questions, but at last, finding himself entangled, he desisted and went to his old occupation of money changing again. If once God would by his Spirit convince him of sin, a Savior would be a blessing indeed to them. But human nature is the same all the world over. All the conviction fails, except it is produced by the effectual working of the Holy Spirit. Carey had this dream from the very beginning. He wanted to live just like the Moravians lived, which was communally, to share everything together, to be on equal footing with the natives, and eventually they would become this self-sufficient community. And he learned of a plot of land about 40 miles east of Calcutta in this place called Debhada, and he could live rent-free with 3 years of homesteading. And the ladies are once again very upset. This is the fourth major move in 3 months, and they would have hated it even more if they knew more about the area before they got there, because there are man-eating tigers and snakes and leopards and rhinos. It's a very dangerous area, and that's why it's offered to them at such a great, great deal. But Carey, he loves it. And they met with an official with the East India Company who allowed them to live with him for 6 months or however long it took them to build a house and get set up. And he's a really nice guy, but he is a deist, which was all the rage in those days. And he and Kitty formed quite an attachment, and the pair got married. Now, it is interesting that she would marry a man who was not a Christian. And I don't know if this gives us any insight into Kitty's faith, if she was just not particularly serious or what was happening there. But I don't know that we can necessarily put this onto Dorothy as much, but there is, I mean, they were very much so in the same mental state of complaining against William and kind of feeling very dejected. So, I mean, it's hard to say, but it doesn't seem like Kitty was altogether that serious. But then after his marriage to Kitty, this guy does eventually become a Christian due to his friendship with William, and the two remained close friends until Short's death in 1802. And at this point, Kitty had actually already left to go back to England. I don't know if she was just kind of living over there full time or whatever. But after her husband died, she actually never came back to India again. So she left Dorothy pretty high and dry, to be honest. But you can't really blame her necessarily. She got married. But there's this guy named Ram Ram Basu. He is the first convert of John Thomas. And he had refused to renounce his caste. He's a Brahmin. He'd refused baptism, and then he had backslid after John Thomas leaves. And he was a syncretist who said that he loved Christianity the best. And he lives with the Careys, and he becomes William's language tutor and translation assistant. And then later on, he would actually commit adultery, and William would be forced to dismiss him from the service. And this had to be done rather delicately, because this occurred after Dorothy's mind kind of slipped and she raved all over town that William was an adulterer. But we will get to that a little bit later. Now, important thing to note here is that William is really going through the hardships of those early days without a church and without any other Christian fellowship. He really missed it. And he missed having just even John Thomas. But the good news is that John actually writes to him to apologize for how he behaved. He says he got kind of too into the world, and he is just, he's in a better place mentally, not like physically, but he's in a better place And around this same time, John Thomas had been in communication with a guy named George Udney, who had previously been in communication with him, had like been business partners or something like that. His brother and sister-in-law had drowned in a tragic accident. And so John had written to him and his mother to express his condolences. They admitted their relationship, which was also broken. He has so many broken relationships throughout his life. But they mend it back, and this guy actually offers them an indigo factory job in a town called Mudnabadi, which is in northern Bengal, as foreman. And this is a really, really great job because it's £250 a year. They get a share of the proceeds if the crop was successful. And kind of a bit of a foreshadowing event is that indigo farming is very fickle, and it could be easily ruined by a bad weather. So that makes it a high-risk investment, but most importantly, and why it was worth it, is because it offered them legal status in India. They wouldn't have to worry about being thrown out, so they would be free to minister without reprisal. And it only required them to be hands-on for about a third of the year, so they'd be free to do ministry for the other, you know, two-thirds of the year. So they had moved, and they lived in this house that had a front porch that looked out onto a pond, which was home to at least one crocodile, and where there's one, probably more than one. And so I just kind of imagine being Dorothy, who's just moving around, and now your sister's, you know, gone, and you're the only one really running the house. But you're trying to wrangle these four boys who were definitely running all over and into that pond, and just how stressful that would be. And once they're all settled in, Carey writes to society to tell them about his plan. And the war had actually made communication very difficult because he hadn't heard from them since he had arrived. And in August 1794, he wrote to tell them that he would no longer need their monetary support because his new position provided for them. And he'd never intended to live on support anyway, and he felt the money should go to other missionary ventures. And the society eventually receives this letter at a meeting when Andrew Fuller is absent. And they fire off this letter, which accuses Carey of being this money grubber for whom the missionary spirit has been swallowed up by the pursuits of the merchant. And Carey receives this letter in January 1796. And he is incensed. And he wrote back, "If my conduct will not vindicate itself, it is not worth vindicating." And he was actually putting up about one third of his own income from the indigo works back into the mission. And he was very adamant that he had not denied the ministry for love of money. And he said, "I am indeed poor, and I shall always be so till the Bible is published in Bengali and Hindustani." And the society was really upset, but they contributed like next to nothing for his like living. It was less than £200 in 3 years. And so they had no room to talk, honestly. And if he had been relying solely on their support, he'd have been an absolute pauper. Now, Fuller is able to smooth this over, and it's a bit of a foretaste for what's to come later when Fuller is no longer alive to patch things up. But that's a part two story. And I want to kind of highlight a bit the difficulties of getting things done in India, because the caste system is a huge, everybody knows this, it's a huge problem in India. And then the Muslims had their own idea of what was, clean, unclean, what they could do, what they could not do. And you really needed a person for every single thing. Nobody was a jack of all trades, which is actually kind of similar here in Indonesia. Like, you have somebody for everything. Like, I've got a milk lady, you got a chicken person, you got your vegetable person, you got, you know, actually our LPG guy, he does water as well. So that's actually kind of rare. But, you know, you just have somebody for everything you need. And for Hindus, they won't do anything that was considered to be above or below their caste. And this proved very problematic when their 5-year-old son, Peter, died of a tropical fever and dysentery. And Carey described Peter as a very fiery and engaging boy, and he was already fluent in Bengali. And they were really shocked by his death because Felix and Dorothy had been sick for 8 months and they were okay. And Carey had just come through a very similar fever himself. And so this was absolutely devastating. And then to add to their pain, they couldn't find anybody to bury him because it was considered unclean. And I think maybe something to do with the fact that they were foreigners as well. And so they had basically resolved to bury him themselves. And I can't imagine how awful that would be to have to, you know, lift up the limp body of your, you know, 5-year-old son yourself. But then two outcasts offered to help them, and these guys actually would eventually suffer retribution from the village leader, which Carey had to intervene in, which is really the last thing a grieving parent wants to do. And then years later, their son Jabez wrote to his father shortly after the death of his own child and said that it was only after burying his own child on foreign soil that he understood what it was like for his mother and father to bury his brother all those years before. Dorothy never recovers from Peter's death, and I read this excellent book that I would recommend to anyone looking to dive a bit deeper into Dorothy's decline. It's called Dorothy Carey, The Tragic and Untold Story of Mrs. William Carey by James R. Beck, who is a Christian psychologist, and he attributes her decline to grief. And I do think he's right, because she had lost these two children previously and had lost her five-year-old in a foreign land with no family aside from media around her. And she was had already been building up this resentment against William for bringing them to India, and her insanity kind of came on slowly, and it manifested in a paranoid jealousy that likely stemmed from her feelings that William was always absent, always working or ministering. And she likely also blamed him for Peter's death, because if they had been in England, he wouldn't have died. So her delusional state then caused her to be convinced that William was having all of these affairs. And she was actually so convincing that other women began to believe this until she accused them as well of sleeping with her husband. A little bit of a family history there is that, or a family, I guess, future there is that Felix would have a similar mental break, which was caused by grief as well, when the ship his wife and small children were in sank and they drowned. And he experiences delusions of grandeur, among other things. And I will link that episode for you if you'd like to hear more about his life. But in the beginning, William actually writes very little on the mental state of Dorothy, and there were signs that she was a bit of a negative Nancy, and this is maybe a little bit, you know, overly simplistic, I guess, but she seemed to be kind of, she was a fearful, anxious person, and I just think she kind of maybe had a negative disposition naturally, so it was possible that it was just hard for him to tell the difference at first. And John Thomas gives us the most clear picture of Dorothy in those early days. He wrote to Andrew Fuller and said, "Mrs. Carey has given us much trouble and vexation, and has formed such black designs and carried them so far into execution that we have been obliged to go to heaven for help. Do you know that she has taken it into her head that Carey is a great whoremonger, and her jealousy burns like fire unquenchable, and this horrible idea has night and day filled her heart for about 10 or 9 months past, so that if he goes out of his door by day or night, she follows him and declares in the most solemn manner that she has caught him with his servants, with his friends, with Mrs. Thomas, that he is guilty every day and night, and she has uttered the most blasphemous and bitter imprecations against him. When Miss Thomas and myself were present, seizing him by the head of his hair of his head, and at one time at the breakfast table, she held up a knife and said, 'Curse you, I could cut your throat.' And she made some other attempt on his life, and for some minutes together, she will say, 'You rascal, you rogue, God Almighty, curse you,' etc., etc., too bad to mention, and far worse, if possible, in obscenity than in profaneness. I need not go any further to convince you that we have had our troubles, for some ladies have almost hesitated till, thank God, she accused them of being intimate with her husband, and then they knew that she was out of her senses. But before that, it was doubtful, because in all other things, she talks sensible, and she minds nobody, nor fears anyone but me. And if I come into the room, she is raving, and then she stops. And she's been in confinement by my advice, yet she speaks highly of me as a good man, but she is deceived in Carey." And later, she tries to send this letter. She does send this letter to Thomas to try to convince him of William's unfaithfulness, and others, including the Udneys or the Udneys, Mrs. Thomas tried to reason with her, but she just doesn't listen. And she's completely reasonable in other areas of her life, at least for a time. Later on, that seems to change a little bit. She does become pregnant around these early months with their youngest son as a way to try to, it seems like, try to cure her delusions, because this was something that was prescribed as a treatment by professionals like Dr. Arnold, whose book he had brought back from England. Obviously, this doesn't work, and he's eventually forced to keep her more confined for longer periods as time kind of goes forward. But in the meantime, on a different note, we'll come back to this a bit later, but in the meantime, William's language proficiency had advanced enough that he was able to hold Sunday evangelistic sermons for anywhere between 200 to 600 Muslims and Hindus. And he would tell them that their holy books were good observations and rules, but they were no remedy for sin and offered no path of forgiveness. He wrote, "I told them that their books were like a loaf of bread in which was a considerable quantity of good flour, but also a very little malignant poison, which made the whole so poisonous that whoever should eat of it would die." And he focused on the good news of the gospel and the infinitely great sacrifice for infinite guilt. There was a giant difficulty in reaching the Hindus because they were so, like, syncretistic and just everything went. And for example, Vishnu, he's a god of love who went through many incarnations in order to help the human race. And his greatest incarnation is Krishna, who lived among the poor and performed deeds of charity. He's killed by wicked men, and yet he's gonna come back. And so they just kind of thought, this Christ of the missionaries is just another version of Krishna. And so only the Bible could show the uniqueness of Christ. And this is why Carrie was so anxious to have it to be translated and disseminated among the people. In May of 1799, the Baptist Church at Olney was having a dedication and commissioning a few new missionaries that had answered Carey's call to join him in the work. We have William Ward, who's a publisher whom Carey had personally spoken to before leaving, and he was ready to help print out their translation work. We had a single woman and then three married couples with their children. One of these couples were Joshua and Hannah Marshman. They were the keepers of a charity school in Bristol, and they were coming with their three children. Hannah added a much-needed motherly touch to the mission. She made sure they ate well and enjoyed a mixture of food from home and from India. And Samuel Pierce, who had so longed to go to India, he now lay on his deathbed. But he had Andrew Fuller read aloud a benediction to the little group, which said, "My most hearty love to each missionary. Happy men, happy women. You are going to be fellow laborers with Christ himself. I congratulate, I almost envy you, yet I love you, and I can scarcely now forbear dropping a tear of love as each of your names passes across my mind. Oh, what promises are yours. Oh, what a reward." He sounds like such a sweet guy. Now, as they're on this boat, they're coming, the Indigo business goes bust. It's not happening. So he has these alternative plans for another Indigo place. So he buys up some land, and he's getting this thing going. And their group arrives via an American ship and then lands in Danish Serampore to avoid getting nabbed by the East India Company. And rumor spreads that there's these Papist missionaries, and you have this, it's the Napoleonic Wars, right? So it's there's these rumors of Napoleon's men, and they were secretly going to infiltrate and then steal India from the British. So they're hauled before the police in Calcutta, and they're like, oh, these guys are just Baptists. They're fine. But stay in Serampore because you're going to get deported if not. So there's a governor of Serampore. He's just like the nicest guy. He's a fellow Christian. And this Serampore used to be a fellowship of Moravians. And they gave up like several years before. And so the governor invites them to set up a mission there. And Carey had just sunk a bunch of money into this new Indigo factory. And he just didn't also like how close this mission would be to a world they call Calcutta. It's 2 hours away. By rowboat, or 16 miles. So he prays with Ward about it, and the next day Ward records his decision that Carey has made up his mind to leave all and follow our Savior to Serampore. They move in January 1800, and Serampore is this melting pot of people, and it's not like the best of people, because it's more like people down on their luck, or they're kind of nefarious individuals from all over the world, really. And it's probably why the governor was so keen to offer them some residence, because they could be a much-needed, a positive influence for these people. And he helps them pick out a plot of land that's along the river, and each family could have their own apartment inside this massive house that could also double as a chapel. And there's other buildings which they would soon repurpose into a boarding school and a print shop. And they took inspiration from the Moravians and used only the barest amounts of money for their personal needs, and the rest went into the mission. And twice a day, they gathered for scripture reading and prayer, and they ate all of their meals together. But they did prepare for the inevitable friction and division, because obviously where you're trying to do good work, you know, there's going to be some problems there. So in his book, Timothy George writes that it was never Carey's plan to rule over the Brotherhood, as he called it, in an authoritarian way. They would rotate preaching and presiding responsibilities, and each Saturday evening there was a community meeting to regulate matters and air any differences which may have arisen during the past week. And the rule was speak up or shut up, because anyone, if they were hurt in their minds and they didn't mention it, they would meet with very little pity afterwards. So honesty, intimacy, equality were the watchwords of the community. And Carrie was really over the moon to have these new helpers. He said that Ward is the very man we needed. I have much pleasure in him. I expect much from him. Marshman is a prodigy of diligence and prudence. Learning the language is mere play to him. He has acquired in 4 months as much as I did in 8. And I'm going to quote Timothy George here again, because I think he puts it really well, that these three, Carrie, Marshman, and Ward, the Serampore trio, they formed a close-knit alliance of mutual support and admiration, which was to make their labors together one of the most illustrious examples of missionary teamwork in the history of the church. Marshman was 7 years younger than Carrie. Ward was 8 years younger. Both men respected the wisdom and piety of their senior colleague, while he, in turn, was loyal and enthusiastic about them. They stood by one another inseparably in good times and in bad, during years of severe trial and through seasons of harvest and joy. And while this group is getting along just so swimmingly, everybody kind of notices that Carrie's kids are a little feral. They had no real formal instruction because obviously their mom is not able to care for them. It's not the servant's job to care for them. And William has got a lot on his plate, so he's not able to care for them either. In fact, he's just not, he just is not the most involved. Like, he has a heart for his kids. He loves his kids. He's actually kind of an indulgent father in that way because I think it's a bit of a guilt he carries for having to be away so often or being preoccupied. So when he is there, he's very, very indulgent. So the Marshmans end up taking these kids under their wings and kind of provide them much needed time and attention and also discipline that they needed. And it really is not a stretch to say that it is highly unlikely that these children would have carried on the missionary service without their intervention and mentoring. William Ward is also a huge influence on Felix. He takes him on as an assistant at the printing press and began to meet with him and his brother for prayer and Bible study. And Ward was an effective mentor who made a deep and lasting impact on Felix. And yet Ward's interest in Felix was kind of a threat to Dorothy, who soon became very delusional about their friendship. Ward wrote about Dorothy in his journal, "We keep her from the table. She has gotten an unfounded idea that I beat the boys, and she calls me all vile names she can think of." One of the things I find most admirable about Carrie's boys is just how much they still loved their mother. Like, obviously, she is their mother. You know, you do love your mother, but they really did love and care for her because William even notes this after her death, that he was just so impressed by how loving that they were to her, even to the end when she is just, I mean, she's rough. She's hard to love, you know, and she's always spewing, you know, just vile things. And I feel like that would be really hard on a child because you spent your whole life like with your mother, just not able to care for you. But I just think it's really quite sweet that they loved her so much and like cared for her in such a wholesome way to the very end. About a year or two after they had settled into Serampore, the governor asked William to mentor a young lady named Charlotte Rumor. And he said, "I was last evening employed in teaching the English language to a German lady who I hope professes the grace of God. She is a person of large fortune. I believe her father was a count, but she informs me that he would never accept anything but his hereditary title. She is from Schleswig and has been instructed in the school of affliction. Last year, she came into the country for her health. For having not been able to speak or stand for some years, her speech is restored and she can walk a little. Her name is Remor. I trust that she has met with some good to her soul in this place." And he later wrote that he had reason to believe that his visits were greatly blessed. And I don't think she was a believer until she began meeting with William, because then I think he like baptizes her and stuff like that. So she's a pastor. He's kind of her pastor. And then she's a great supporter of missions after she becomes a believer. But we'll come back to her a little bit later. So stay tuned for that. Now, John Thomas, for the last few years, it's kind of hard to see where he had been. He wasn't necessarily in the best frame of mind for those early years at Serampore, but he does come back a little while before their first convert. He has a share in helping lead their first convert, Indian convert, to the Lord. And this convert's name is Krishna Paul, who used to work as a carpenter for the Moravians years before, which is where he first heard the gospel. But then he came under the influence of a guru who told him he needed to wash in the river and to say these mantras every day to release his sins and then also to do good works and all, you know, all that stuff. But he was actually walking down to the river in late November to complete these rites when he slipped and dislocated his shoulder. So he'd heard that there was this doctor who was staying with the Serampore mission people. And so he has his children go and get them. And so Thomas and Marshman and Carrie all came together, and Thomas puts the arm back in the socket. And they shared the gospel with him, and they gave him this track that was in the style of a Hindu mantra, which said, "Sin confessing, sin forsaking, Christ's righteousness embracing, the soul is free." And he begins attending Bible study with his wife and children. And then Thomas will run into him a little bit later. And Krishna said, "I'm a great sinner, but I have confessed my sin and I am free." And then Thomas replies to him and says, "Then I call you brother. Come and let us eat together in love." Now, this seems like not that big of a deal, right? But actually, it's a really huge deal, because to eat with a European was to break caste. It just wasn't done. And so Krishna's acceptance to eat with them was a sign of real repentance. And then he gets called a traitor by, you know, his people, his village. And his oldest daughter was then stolen and given to her betrothed, who was a Hindu. And then later, though, the good news is they both became Christians, and you know, he moved back with them and stuff. But I think this is an interesting kind of like insight into how these early missions were done and how you kind of work in a cross-cultural context like this, because there are still questions people come up with, like, oh, what do you do with like polygamists or things like that? And, you know, there's all sorts of different thoughts about this. But Carrie was very firm in the fact that he actually refused to baptize people who wouldn't break caste, because he saw it as a sign that they were not truly saved, because the caste system and Christianity are incompatible. Ward records the day when, as Carrie put it, they desecrated the holy Ganges. And the Ganges is seen as this direct extension of the goddess, I guess it'd be Ganga, who represents purity and salvation. And the water is supposed to cleanse and then grant salvation. And the great irony here is that on this day, it served as a witness for the declaration of salvation, which can only be found in Christ. And that is really awesome. But Ward wrote that Sunday, December 28th, 1800, after our English service, which I preached on baptism, we went to the riverside immediately opposite our gate, when the governor, a number of Europeans and Portuguese, and many Hindus and Mohammedans attended, and we sang in Bengali, "Jesus and Shall It Ever Be?" And then Carrie then spoke in Bengali, particularly declaring that we did not think the water sacred, but water only. And the one from among them about to be baptized professed this act to put off all sins and all debts and to put on Christ. And after prayer, he went down to the bank of the river, taking Felix in his right hand, and then he baptized Felix. And then Krishna went down and was baptized with the words in Bengali, and all was silence. The governor could not restrain his tears, and almost everyone seemed struck with the solemnity of this new ordinance. I never saw in the most orderly congregation in England anything more impressive. "Ye gods of stone and clay, did ye not tremble when in the triune name one soul shook from you his feet as dust?" Krishna would go on to be an evangelist among his own people, and 2 years after his baptism, he wrote to Serampore to say, "The love of God, the gospel of Jesus Christ, was made known by holy brother Thomas. On that day, our minds were filled with joy. In this rejoicing and in Christ's love believing, I obtained mercy. Now this word I will tell the world. Going forth, I will proclaim the love of Christ with rejoicing. To sinners, I will say this word. Hear, sinner brother, without Christ, there is no help. Christ, able to save, gave his own soul. Such compassion, where shall we get?" And sadly, John Thomas had passed away the year before this letter was written. His mental state had deteriorated the week before Krishna's baptism, and he had to actually be put in a straitjacket. And later, he was institutionalized for not quite a month. And after his release, he received a letter of rebuke from the org in England. And we don't know what it said, but it pushed him over the edge. And by the end, he was described as completely deranged. And he died of a fever in October of 1801. And he was arguably Dorothy's only friend of sorts, kind of, you know, it's a bit difficult. But during her own struggles, she was considered him as a friend. And we don't know if she was aware that he had died, what kind of state she was in, if she would be able to actually understand that he had died. There's just no knowledge on that. And then Dorothy herself died about 6 years later on December 8th, 1807. And we get the most detail from Ward, who relates that she labored under a 2-week fever. Her death was a very easy one, but there was no appearance of the return of reason, nor anything that could cast a dawn of hope or life on her state. And her death was reported in an English newspaper with the briefest of lines, which said, "Mrs. Carey, having been ill for about a fortnight, died." I mentioned this at the top of the episode, but sadly, Dorothy has been demonized by a lot of her biographers for years. She's been called a dull, commonplace woman who was deplorably unsuited to be William's wife. One of Dorothy's female biographers said it was an unlucky marriage, for she was a dull, ignorant woman with no feeling for her husband's high aims or superior powers. Another labeled her as a literate, weak-minded woman who never had the slightest sympathy with his undertakings and was utterly unsuited for his companionship. And these are horrible words that are written by people who never knew her or shared in any of her sufferings. And it really is quite easy to write these things, you know, from a safe and cozy home 200 plus years after the fact when William Carey's legacy is well established. But the son of Joshua Marshman and her own grandson wrote that they hoped the future would see her in a better light. And Beck's book about Dorothy includes this really poignant quote from a woman named H.L. Macbeth, who I think said it really well. She said, "Somewhere in missionary history, a word of compassion should be written for Dorothy Carey, who paid a high price for Baptist missions and never knew why." And I don't want to leave you here for the end of part one, because that really would be quite depressing. So Carey wrote to his sisters to tell them of Dorothy's death, but he includes a very interesting tidbit at the end, which reads, "I am well aware that there is a degree of indelicacy in mentioning so early my design to marry again after a proper time. But as I shall not be able to write to you very often, as some things connected within therewith may contribute to your comfort, I shall inform you that I do intend, after some months, to marry Miss Remore. I have proposed the matter to her, and she has testified her agreement thereto. She is one of the most pious and conscientious persons with whom I am acquainted, and is 2 or 3 months older than myself. She possesses some property which will enable me to do things for my something for my relations, and it is in consequence of a wish she expressed that I communicate my intention to you so early." And this announcement, which is also shared with the mission, caused shockwaves. Nobody was happy about it. They all felt it's way too soon, which is really saying something for early 19th century Europe, because those guys got married like, you know, that, remarried, drop of a hat, you know. But there was actually a petition, a protest that circulated around the mission to halt this wedding. But William carried on. That's funny. But he carried on, and the two were married on May 9th, 1808. And eventually people kind of let it go because they actually liked Charlotte. You know, she's not a bad soul. And the marriage is actually a really happy one. And there's evidence that perhaps he learned from some of the mistakes he made in his relationship with Dorothy and then worked to make this one better. In 1814, he wrote a letter to his newlywed son, Jabez, who had just moved with his wife to Ambon in Maluku, which is in Indonesia. And I'll link the letter in full for those who want to read it, but in part, he wrote this. "You are now a married man. Be not satisfied with conducting yourself towards your wife with propriety, but let love to her be the spring of your conduct towards her. Esteem her highly, and so act that she may be induced thereby to esteem you highly. The first impressions of love arising from form and beauty will soon wear off, but the esteem arising from excellency of disposition and substance of character will endure and increase. Her honor is now yours, and she cannot be insulted without your being degraded. I hope as soon as you can get on board and are settled into your cabin, you will begin and end each day by uniting together to pray and praise God. Let religion always have a place in your house. If the Lord bless you with children, bring them up in the fear of God, and be always an example to others of the power of godliness. This advice I give also to Eliza, and if it is followed, you will be happy." And this is where we will end part one. In part two, we will conclude William's story, and we'll talk more specifically about the work of the Serampore Mission and the ministry of his 27 remaining years, including his professorship and his work on some of the social injustices that were happening in India. As always, thank you for listening to Martyrs and Missionaries. I'm Elise.
Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free Select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust. For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman. Available at Lowe's. We help. You save. Valid through 5/21. While supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.